Good morning. My name is Oleg Chernyshov, and I will be giving lectures on condensed matter core this week and the third week of this course. Dennis will be your lecturer during the second week when I will be away. I teach physics and do research at the Johns Hopkins University. My specialty is condensed matter physics, specifically magnetism. So you will see some of that in week one. As I understand, you have very diverse interests, and not all of you, perhaps, will be doing condensed matter physics. But I will try to make it exciting and tell you what things are like in our field. I will appreciate questions. Feel free to interrupt me at any point. I like it when the audience interacts with me. Talking to an audience that is not saying anything is very hard. So this should be interactive. I will have something that you can call office hours on Wednesdays when you are free. So feel free to come to my office during the afternoon, and we can discuss things that might be of interest to you. So week one is going to be an introduction to various field theories in condensed matter physics. Today we will start with crystals and related field theory of phonons or lattice vibrations. Tomorrow we will start with ferromagnetic materials, spin waves, which are linear waves, and then on Wednesday we'll do nonlinear excitations, nonlinear solitons and ferromagnets. Antiferromagnets will be discussed in Thursday lecture, and then on Friday we'll do electrons in a lattice. During week two, Dennis will discuss Fermi gas and interacting electrons, as well as superconductivity.
And as well as passing integral approaches.
Of course. Goes without saying, this is all going to be oriented toward field theory. And week three is to be determined mostly, but the outlines are will probably be at the point where we discuss the Ginzburg-Landau theory of superconductivity, which is quite elegant, and discuss topological states of matter, and I'll tell you later what that is. Any questions? Okay, so here's the plan for today. We're going to start discussing crystals. First in one spatial dimension, which is the easiest thing to do mathematically, discuss lattice vibrations, first using the lattice formulation, then a continuum one, and then discuss what changes when you go to higher dimensions, because it turns out the crystals in one dimension don't have all the interesting properties that we ascribe to solids. So we'll discuss resistance to shear and things like that. And then finally, we'll quantize these vibrations, probably going back to one dimension. So I'm not sure if I'll have the time to cover the last topic, so that probably will be a little bit sketchy, but my notes will be available to you, so everything should be fine. Okay, so let's begin. So I'm going to draw a sketch of a one-dimensional crystal. It's an arrangement of atoms that is periodic. So for now, I'll have just a single dimension x, and the atoms will be arranged periodically like this with coordinates 0, a, 2a, 3a, 4a, 5a, and so on. So the position of the nth atom is n times a in equilibrium. There are some complicated interactions between atoms, but the outcome is that they just end up being equally spaced when you don't touch them. So they form a periodic array. In doing so, they break a symmetry of the vacuum. Which symmetry? Translational symmetry, right? You can shift all of them. They could have been all shifted to the right a little bit by half of the lattice spacing, or to the left by a quarter of the lattice spacing, or they just choose to be in that position. So it can be anywhere. And it does break the translational symmetry. You used to be able to translate the vacuum by any distance. Now the only thing you can do is make translations by exactly one lattice spacing in order to see the same pattern. Right? So there's a broken translational symmetry. So this will have interesting consequences. In particular, there will be a Goldstone mode associated with this spontaneously broken symmetry. And that Goldstone mode is vibrations of the lattice, or phonons, as they're known in the quantum version. So in order to describe the dynamics of this crystal, for small deviations of the atoms from equilibrium, we can introduce a variable called the displacement. So the position of the nth atom will be n times a plus a small deviation from that equilibrium position, u sub n. And we're going to start out by writing out the Lagrangian. Which would be the difference of the kinetic and potential energies. So the kinetic energy is easy to write out. This is going to be just mass times velocity squared over 2. And since Na is a constant, this is just going to be the sum of m times um dot squared divided by 2. I will write out the potential energy, and then I will explain why it has the following form. So I'll write it out like this. It would be k times the difference of the displacements for neighboring atoms. This is a toy model. This is not necessarily the most general description. But it was constructed under the following assumptions. First, this is an expansion in powers of the displacement. Right, so we were thinking about small deviations, and so perhaps we can write some sort of a Taylor series. The zeroth order term is not of interest to us, it's just a constant. And there should be no first order terms. Why should be no first order terms in this case? There would be a force in that case acting on the atom, and so that's why there should be no first order terms. So it should be a quadratic expression in the u's. Here we have it. And then another requirement is that the potential energy should not change if we shift all the atoms uniformly. That is, if un is equal to just a single number, the same for all atoms. This expression satisfies all of these conditions. Right? You shift everything by C, then the energy would be exactly zero. This is not the only expression that can satisfy that. I could include interaction between second neighbors, right? Atoms number n and n plus 2, n and n plus 3, and so on. I chose not to. This is the simplest expression I can write. So it's just the nearest neighbor interacting spin chain, and you can draw little springs connecting the atoms. The springs are kind of unstretched in equilibrium, and then once you shift one atom relative to another, then there is a potential energy associated with that. Okay, so in the tutorial, you'll discuss a more general model where you have further neighbor interactions. And sometimes there can be interesting effects associated with that if the interactions between atoms are long-ranged. If they're short-ranged, then the theory will be pretty much very similar, at least in the long wavelength limit. Right. So we have this form of potential and kinetic energies. And so now we can write down the full Lagrangian and use the Euler-Lagrange equations to determine the equations of motion. So it's d dt partial derivative with respect to the velocity minus partial derivative with respect to coordinate equal to 0. So for every variable u sub n, we'll have the following. Equation. M times the second derivative minus k times un minus 1 minus twice un and then plus un plus 1 equal to 0. What kind of an equation is that? It's a differential equation, of course, right? And it's a linear differential equation. So it's easy to solve, right? How do we solve it? We can do a Fourier transform. In other words, let's try a wave solution. So the displacement of the nth particle will be some constant times. Sorry, this is not a constant. It's a constant in space, but it might depend on time. So some amplitude c of t times e to I k times n times a. N times a is the position, right? So it's like e to I k x. If I substitute this ansatz into this equation, I will have, after the cancellation of the exponentials, I'll have m times c double dot equal minus k times e to minus ika for the first term, minus 2 for the second term, and then plus e to ika for the last term, times c equal to 0. So what I find is that it's a simple harmonic oscillator now. C double dot plus 2k over m times 2 minus 2 cosine ka times c equal to 0. So this constant here should be the square of the frequency. Right. And so I obtain the spectrum of frequencies for the lattice vibration waves. Omega squared becomes, or omega, let's put it this way, it'll be extra factor of 2. So it's the square root of 2k over m times 1 minus cosine ka. Or if I use trigonometry, I can replace 1 minus cosine with the sine squared of the half of the argument. So that's 2 times root k over m times sine ka over 2. So let's draw this dispersion relation, or the frequency dependence on the wave number. K along the horizontal axis, omega along the vertical axis. And I have a sine wave that goes like this. This is zero wave number, and it goes back to zero at 2 pi divided by a. It has a maximum at pi over a. Okay. I can also continue to the right, to the left. I'll have the same shape pretty much. And I can continue to the right, and it'll have the same shape. And what are you observing here? In this direction, what is this function like? Periodic, right? And in fact, the periodicity is a very important thing for lattice problems like this. If I shift by the quantity 2 pi divided by a, I will get the exact same frequency again, right? So if I shift from here to here, I get the exact same frequency. In fact, this is to be expected because waves with the wave numbers k that differ by that amount are actually identical. They're the same wave. So let's look at the wave with k number, with wave number k. That's un equal to constant times minus I omega t times e to I k n a. And then I'm going to look at the wave number k prime, which is k plus this number 2 pi over a. So then the wave will have the following form. It's c e to minus I omega t. The frequency is the same. And then it's multiplied by I k n a times e to I 2 pi over a times n a. The lattice constant a cancels out. And as you can see, since n is an integer, this number is just 1. So if I shift the wave number by 2 pi over a, I don't get a new wave. I get one of the waves that I've previously considered. And so that means that we don't need to consider all wave numbers. We can just stick to this range between 0 and 2 pi over a. Anything outside of that interval will already be covered within here. So let's just stick to waves either within this interval, 2 pi divided by a upper range, 0 lower range, or we can use some alternative arrangements. We can consider waves between wave numbers minus pi over a and pi over a. Right. So in fact, this will be our preferred choice. That would amount to sticking with waves within this range. Right. So we'll have waves coming out from the origin approximately linearly and then saturating at minus pi over a and pi over a. Right. And the rest of it doesn't give us anything new. So we'll just erase it. Great. So that's the interval we're going to work with. It's an important enough concept to deserve a name. This is called the first Bouillon zone. And then the continuations to the right or to the left would be additional Bouillon zones. You can consider the second Bouillon zone, which is outside of this, the third one, and so on. This will not give you anything new, so you can stick just to one of these. Any questions? So I mentioned here Goldstone modes. Did you guys discuss Goldstone modes yet? In any other course? Have you heard the name? Yeah. Okay. So Goldstone modes are important because they're consequences of a broken symmetry, spontaneously broken symmetry, which is continuous. So here we had spontaneously broken translational symmetries. And the Goldstone modes are the vibrational waves near zero wave number whose frequencies go to zero. These are kind of Goldstone modes. In fact, we can describe these Goldstone modes without all the complications of a lattice theory where we had to work on a lattice. Instead, what we'll do here is we'll make a continuum formulation of the same problem. A field theory. And we'll see how these vibrations with the linearly rising frequency with the wave number can be derived in a simpler way. And we'll see that this is a feature of crystals in general and not specifically of the STOI model. You'll confirm this in a tutorial where you will consider more general interactions, but under reasonable circumstances, you'll always find waves with linearly increasing frequencies with the wave number. Under some unreasonable circumstances, the spectrum might change. If you have very long range interactions, the spectrum will become gapped. It will start from a finite frequency and will not go to zero as k goes to zero. Okay, so we worked with discrete numbers, discrete displacements of the lattice, U1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on. We will now regard them as a variable defined in the continuum. So we'll regard this as a function of the position of the atom. So it's U of x, where x is n times a. If we're really interested in the lattice description, we'll recall that. But if we're interested in the long wavelength properties of our phonons, of our lattice vibrations, if we're not interested in working on the lattice scale, then we can regard this as a continuously varying parameter. Okay. And so in that case, my kinetic energy can be written starting with the original expression. It will be u dot of an a and t squared divided by 2. And so I'm going to convert this to an integral. Right. What do I need to convert a discrete sum to an integral? The magic recipe is to multiply everything by delta x, right? So I'll write this as m u dot square root over 2 times delta x. But this is a factor that I should compensate by dividing by the same factor. Delta x is a. It's the distance between adjacent atoms, right? So that's 1. But then this whole thing times delta x summed over n looks like an integral. And so this will be approximately an integral from 0 to some length L of the chain dx m u dot squared of x and t divided by 2a. And so I'll write this as density times u dot squared over 2 dx, where the density is mass divided by the lattice spacing in one dimension. In higher dimensions, that I would have to divide by a to the number of dimensions. Or maybe I'll keep this here. So I can do the same thing with the potential energy U, which originally is some constant times the finite difference of two numbers un plus 1 and un. And if I regard them as a function at two different points in space, this would be approximately du dx times a. And I'm going to drop the terms higher order in the lattice constant a. And so this would be approximately the sum over n k u prime squared divided by 2, where u prime is partial derivative with respect to x, and u dot is partial derivative with respect to time. A squared is missing, right? Just checking. So I can use one of the a's as delta x to convert this to an integral, and the other a will stay there. So this will be approximately the integral dx from 0 to L, kA u prime squared over 2. So I can combine these two letters into something else, what's called a sigma. So you will have the potential energy written as sigma times the spatial derivative squared over 2. So that gives us our Lagrangian. It's the integral of the Lagrangian density that depends on the field, its spatial derivative, and its time derivative. So rho u dot squared over 2 minus sigma u prime squared over 2. So our field theory is fully defined by this Lagrangian. We can write down the Euler-Lagrange equations of motion. Which this time would be partial derivative with respect to time of the partial derivative of Lagrangian with respect to the time derivative, plus the same with the spatial derivative. And then partial derivative with respect to the field itself, right? Equal to 0. Well, it's easy to do. There's only time derivative and spatial derivative, but there is no u dependence. And so we have rho u double dot minus sigma u double prime equal to 0, which has a the celebrated wave equation. Describing what kind of waves? Harmonic waves moving left and right. Right, so the general solution can be written as function of x plus vt and another function of x minus vt, where the velocity of the waves is square root of sigma over rho. Or we can write an ansatz that would be a plane wave, a constant times e to minus I omega t and plus I kx, and obtain minus rho omega squared plus sigma k squared equal to 0. So omega would be the square root of rho over sigma, sigma over rho, times the wave number. Waves with a linear spectrum, omega proportional to k.
Sigma on rho?
Yes. You know, sometimes my hands write faster than my brain thinks. And since we figured out what the sigma and the rho quantities are, so rho was mass divided by A, and sigma was spring constant times A, so we have k over m under the square root times k times A. So that's our long wavelength spectrum, or small k spectrum. For k, much less than 1 over A. So if you compare the two formulas, this one and the one boxed, they will agree for small values of k times a, right? Okay, so we were able to reproduce the linearly dispersing spin waves here and here. And so this is why I've chosen to work with the Brillouin zone around 0, because if I instead use the Brillouin zone between 0 and 2 pi over a, this is a very large wave number, and so I would not be able to use this trick. So stick near 0. Questions?
Which step are we assuming that you're interested in the long latent?
Very good. When we were writing that U of UN could be represented as a continuous function of n times a, right? If your wave number is small and your wavelength is much longer than the lattice spacing, then the displacements vary slowly with the position. But if I work near 2 pi over a, then they oscillate very fast, and so I cannot do that. Okay. So which formulation did you find the easier one? The lattice one or the continuum one? The continuum? Anyone for the lattice here? Any budding condensed matter theorists? No. Okay. Well, in that case, we should try and write a formulation of a crystal in a higher dimension, like 2 or 3, using a continuum theory right away. Let's not muck around with lattices. You'll do that in a homework assignment, I believe. So in 2 dimensions, for instance, you can have, again, a periodic arrangement of atoms, such as, for instance, a square lattice like this. Or you can have something like a hexagonal or triangular lattice, as it's called. In fact, these arrangements are seen more often than those. And in 3 dimensions, you can have cubic lattices, rhombohedral lattices, all kinds of lattices. It can also be more complicated than this. Instead of a square, you might have rectangles. A square stretched along one direction, or you might have parallelograms. In fact, these crystals are also seen. When you look at these structures, what's the difference from one dimension, aside from having more dimensions? As far as broken symmetries are concerned, what is the main difference? You break not only translations, but also rotations. Right? And so there will be an interesting consequence of that. Okay? So we have broken translations and rotations. So it looks pretty complicated. But as we saw with the one-dimensional example, even though we start with the lattice theory with discrete systems, we can probably get away with constructing a field theory. So we should be able to get something like a field theory in this case as well. And so the information about all this underlying lattice complexity will be encoded in some parameters, like the density of mass rho and the stiffness sigma or something like that. And other than that, there should be no complications, hopefully. All right, so as we construct our field theory, we'll be guided by some simple considerations similar to the ones that I've advanced for the one-dimensional case. All right, so now we have a displacement field. U of R and T. Or I can also write this as ui of r and t, where I goes from 1 all the way up to d, whatever the number of dimensions is. Right. Again, as I write down the kinetic energy, that should be simple. Should be the sum over all these atoms, ui dot divided by 2. So I'm going to use the Einstein convention. Whenever you see a doubly repeated index, you do what? Sum over it, right? So I from 1 to d. So that's simple enough, and this can be converted again by multiplying by delta x, delta y, whatever, divided by a squared in 2 dimensions, right? So this can be approximated as integral rho ui dot divided by 2 times the volume element, where rho is the atomic mass divided by a to the power d, the number of dimensions. So that was easy enough. When we write out the potential energy, it should satisfy certain criteria. So first, it should be low order in the displacement field itself. So there should be no first order terms, because otherwise it will not be in equilibrium. And then a uniform displacement should not change should not influence the potential energy, right? So you shift all the atoms by the same amount, you just are moving the crystal, and it should not affect its potential energy. So presumably this would be some sort of a quadratic expression in the gradients of U. Sound like a good idea? Yeah, so that'll be precisely that. Except we have to think a little bit about the Cartesian indices here, right? So you have a gradient that has Cartesian indices, and you have the displacement itself that has Cartesian indices. So at first sight, U should depend on quantities like this. Partial I uj. How about that? Sound reasonable? It will depend on them, but actually on a slightly more specific version of that. So instead of this, we'll actually write down a symmetrized linear combination. Partial I uj plus partial j ui. The reason for doing that is that in addition to this one, you can have an anti-symmetric combination. And the energy should not depend on these. Should depend on those, but not on these. You want to venture a guess why? Rotational symmetry, exactly. These characterize rotations, right? So if you have a displacement field that does, for instance, the following in 2 dimensions, it's minus epsilon y, epsilon x, this represents a rotation. Let's see. Let's take a square. Right? So this point will shift along, right? So it has zero y coordinate and it has a positive x coordinate. So it's going to shift upwards along the y axis. This point has zero x and a non-zero y, so it'll shift to the left, right? And so you can continue that for other points on the square, and you'll find that this is how various points move, and that's precisely a rotation. A rotation doesn't change the shape of the crystal, and presumably a global rotation should keep its energy unchanged. Okay, so that's why things should not depend on this, and they should depend on that. So So what kind of a quantity is this? Let's think about that, right? So instead of this form of a displacement, we'll take this one, which is more symmetric, epsilon y for the first component, epsilon x for the second component. Right, so again, we take a square and look at the displacements of the various points. So this point will still displace upward, right? We haven't changed the y component, but this point will displace to the right instead of displacing to the left. Right, so you'll have something like this. And when you look at the corners, this is what the corners will do. So what are you doing with this square? You're squeezing it along one diagonal and expanding along the other diagonal. This deformation is called a shear. Okay. Another shear deformation would be if you do this. Okay? So you shift the upper edge to the right, the lower edge to the left, and it's equivalent to squeezing it just like that and rotating it a bit in the opposite direction, okay? So this is a superposition of a shear and a rotation. So the potential energy should depend on shear, but not on the rotational part, and that's why it'll depend on these quantities. I would waste a lot of time if I wrote this thing in the Lagrangian. So I'm going to introduce a shorthand for that. So U sub ij is the symmetrized derivative partial I uj. Okay?
Can we split up the trace part from this one and see what this corresponds to?
Split up what?
This corresponds to the symmetric.
Oh, that's a very good question. We won't. We'll keep that. Right. So, in fact, another displacement field. Actually, let's consider this one. Right. Epsilon x, epsilon y. This is what you were proposing to trace out. What does this displacement field look like? Here's what it looks like. It's expanding in all directions. Should the potential energy change if you do this? Yeah. It's a density change, and so the potential energy should certainly respond to that. Well, in fact, this kind of a deformation is not really a deformation, it's an inflation of the crystal, but it still resists that. But here's the crucial difference between liquids and solids. A liquid would resist this, but it will not resist that. Liquids are only sensitive to the changes in density. But if you shear them, they will gladly flow. Solids resist shear. And so that's the difference between liquids and solids. And again, it's the consequence of a rotational symmetry breaking. That's the important consequence. Thank you. Very good question. So we'll see that we have to somehow think more about the shear, and you'll see where it comes in. And it will affect the spectrum of our excitations. Any other questions, by the way? OK, so at this point, we'll construct the following potential energy. It's going to be an integral. And then there should be some proportionality to the following, kij kl multiplying uij ukl divided by 2. Right? So it's a quadratic expression. It depends on these symmetrized shear variables, or strains, rather. Right? So we'll call this a strain. And if you take a strain and you multiply it by the fourth rank tensor that we have here, this is just the elastic constant tensor, kij kl times ukl, you'll have a quantity with which indices? I and J, right? And this quantity is called stress. So basically, K, I, J, K, L is the tensor connecting strain to stress. It's a complicated tensor. It has lots of components, right? It's D to the fourth components, or, yeah. But it has some restrictions, right? So not all of these components are exactly independent. So it's symmetric under what?
IJ
with KL, exactly, right? So IJ with KL, it should be symmetric under that. What else?
I and J,
right? Anything else? K and L, exactly. So we don't have to symmetrize it with respect to I and J and K and L because UIJ and UKL is already symmetric. But if we admitted an anti-symmetric part into this tensor, it would be silly because it would be just traced out. So let's keep it symmetric under all three transformations. So in fact, if you did this in a crystal with a cubic symmetry, you would only need, right, so nominally you would think that you have to have, it's a cubic crystal, you would think that you need 64 or 64 coefficients, but in fact you don't. And there are lots of symmetries that reduce this number down to 3. So for instance, you need a coefficient like KXX, XX, and it'll be the same as KYY, YY obviously, right? So all the directions X, Y, and Z are equivalent. And so these will all be the same. You will need the constant like KXX, YY, okay? So a strain in the y direction will cause some stress in the x direction. And that'll be the same as KXX, ZZ, KZZ, YY, and so on. What other constants would you need?
XY, XY,
very good. Okay, and it will be, again, related to a bunch of other constants. Anything else we need? How about KXX, XY? Why not? This is going to be odd under a reflection Y to minus Y, or under a reflection x to minus x. So this component would be 0. Right. So whenever it has an index, this index has to be present 0, 2, or 4 times in a cubic crystal. And so these are just the three constants that we will need in a cubic crystal. If the crystal is less symmetric, a monoclinic one, which has parallelepipeds instead of cubes as its unit cell, then we're screwed. It's not 64 components, but it's still a big number, right? But we won't do that. So we'll try to work with something that's as symmetric as possible. And here, I will present you with a model of a rotationally symmetric solid, or isotropic solid. Which is a toy model, and it turns out that there are isotropic solids in two dimensions if it's a hexagonal crystal. That has a substantially high symmetry to justify this. Cubic crystals will turn out to be not symmetric enough, and they will not be described by this, or square crystals. And you will work with a square crystal in either your homework or tutorial, I forget which. So for an isotropic solid, KIJ, KL should be expressible in terms of our favorite symmetric tensor of all times. What is that favorite tensor? Yes, the Kronecker delta, right? So we're going to write it as a combination of various tensors of that sort. So the first one of them would be delta ij times delta kl. This is symmetric under both the exchange of ij with kl, and individually I with j, k with l works. What else? Well, we can have some other number multiplying delta ik times delta jl. How's that? Does it work? It's symmetric under the exchange of ij with kl. But it's not yet symmetric under the individual exchanges of I with J and K with L. So we'll have to add here a twin, delta IL, delta KJ, or JK. So that's symmetric as required. Nothing else comes to mind. So we'll have a crystal defined by two elastic constants. So lambda and mu are known as the Lamé coefficients. They're not Lame, they're Lamé. Okay, so if I simplify this now, if I substitute this form, so for instance, delta ij will make this, when you put it next to uij, you will just have uii, right? And you will have ukk or something like that. And so you will have the following expression for the potential energy. It will be 1 half lambda times uii ujj. And then the second term would be mu times uij uij. It gives you two different terms. So if you look at this, what would be your interpretation of the term lambda? It's the response to density changes, right? Since uii is the divergence of the displacement, partial iui, that's minus change in density. So this is the bulk modulus. Okay. So it determines the response to an overall change in density or uniform expansion and the corresponding change in the uniform stress, which is the change in pressure. So it's density pressure thing. Liquids would have it. Or fluids, liquids and gases. It's the second term that distinguishes a crystal from a fluid. A fluid would not have the second term. So nonetheless, you can see that it's a toy model. It only has two elastic constants, whereas the cubic crystal would have three, for instance. Yes?
So a question. If a fluid is dissipative, for instance, Navier-Stokes theory, it would have terms like this, right?
So yeah, like yeah, terms. Of course. And so, like, and so if you have, if you consider the dynamics of a fluid, right? So you have two plates, and then you start shearing them, then of course the fluid will resist that. The question, though, is what is the static response? And if you shift the two plates, the fluids will flow a bit, and there will be no residual shear strain. Sorry, no stress, okay? So it'll just shear easily. So this is the question about the static properties, not the dynamic properties. Okay. So now we've got our Lagrangian. The Lagrangian density L script is now rho u dot I over 2. And then we have these two elastic term, minus 1 half lambda uii minus mu uij uij. And these are the spatial derivatives. So if you now use the Euler-Lagrange equations, you can obtain the equations of motion for this crystal. Right, so we'll have partial t dl du dot I minus partial xj, sorry, xi, no, j, right, partial l with respect to the partial derivative, partial j ui. Equal to 0. And since what we have here is the symmetrized version of that, right, uij, we might as well differentiate with respect to the symmetrized version. It'll be the same answer. Oh, this one, yes, it's uii ujj. Thank you. It should be quadratic, of course. So here are the equations of motion. Rho u double dot I minus lambda partial I ujj minus mu partial j uij equal to 0. I'm not deriving it. You can do that if you're interested. So let's see what transpires. So we have u double dot I equals lambda over rho. And so this would be partial I partial j times uj. So the lambda term, and then, sorry, this is factor of 2 here. Plus 2 mu, sorry, factor of 2 will cancel when I use the symmetrized version here, right, which is half. It's mu times partial j partial I uj, and then plus mu times partial j ui. Bit of a mess. Well, it can be simplified slightly. So you'll have u double dot I equals, so mu is also divided by rho. So one of these terms can be actually appended to the lambda term because it's, let's say this one has partial I partial j uj just like the lambda term does, right? So it's lambda plus mu over rho times that, partial I partial j uj, plus mu over rho times partial j ui. How do we solve this? Well, Fourier transform, right? So we're going to write u as some constant times e to ik dot r minus I omega t, and use this ansatz to simplify this equation. So what we will have then is, let me swap the left-hand side and the right-hand side. So I'll have lambda plus mu over rho times ki kj times cj plus mu over rho times k squared ci equal to omega squared times ci.
Comparing that equation to like Navier-Stokes equation, the only difference that I see is the first term and the fact that you don't have a pressure term. Could you introduce a pressure?
Well, we're not adding external pressure, right? We're considering free oscillations of our crystal.
But in principle, you could consider like a solid.
Yeah, but then in principle, what will happen is when you apply pressure, the crystal will change its density and maybe shape if the pressure is not is not isotropic. So it'll be our new starting point.
Okay.
So it's a linear analysis of the free vibrations of a crystal under whatever conditions it finds itself. Okay, so this looks like a matrix equation. I can write the left-hand side as some matrix Aij times Cj equals omega squared times Ci. So it's an eigenvalue problem. And the matrix would be this. So the first term is lambda plus mu over rho times Ki Kj. The second term is mu over rho k squared times the Kronecker delta. So I need to find the eigenvalues of this matrix. It's a simple enough problem. Just to take up a particular case, let's say we're in two dimensions. And let's say our wave number is directed along x. Since we're considering an isotropic crystal, it shouldn't matter in which direction k points, and the results will be valid mutatis mutandis for other directions. So in that case, this matrix will have the following elements. So the x component will have kx times kx, both are k, and so it's going to be lambda plus mu over rho times k squared. And then the second term will also contribute, right? So it's plus another mu over rho k squared. The off-diagonal components of this tensor are exactly zero because k only has the x components but not y components, right? So 0 and 0 here. And then k has no y component, so the first term will not contribute anything, and the second term will contribute mu over rho times k squared. So the problem is already diagonalized, in fact. So we'll have two waves. The x polarized wave and the y polarized wave. So the one that's parallel to the direction of the wave number will have a frequency equal to square root of lambda plus 2 mu divided by rho times k. And so we've got sound waves, and this is called the longitudinal sound. Right? The atoms vibrate in the same direction as the crystal, as the wave propagates. So this is the longitudinal one. For the displacements orthogonal to the direction of the wave number, the dispersion is square root of mu over rho times k. This is the transverse sound. There is the difference between solids and fluids laid bare. In a fluid, mu is zero, and there is no transverse sound. Shear is not resisted by fluid, not a static shear anyway. In a solid, you've got a transverse vibrational wave. Mu is not the viscosity. We're not considering here dissipation at all. It's the resistance to static shear. Applying static shear generates a static stress that tries to return the crystal to the original position. Right? So you can't shear it forever. The crystal will resist. So if you apply a finite shear stress, you will only be able to shear it that much. Whereas in the fluid, you can just keep going. OK? And if we had additional dimensions, which branch would appear? Which branches would appear? In d dimensions, how many of which phonons would we have? Still one longitudinal phonon and d minus one transverse phonons. Whereas in the fluid, you only have one longitudinal phonon, nothing else. Good. Any other questions? So maybe one comment about the fate of these waves in more realistic crystals. If you have a cubic crystal, for example, you will still have a similar outcome, except you will not have strictly longitudinal and strictly transverse phonons, in the sense that the direction of vibration will not be strictly parallel or strictly orthogonal to the direction of the wave number. This will only happen for spatial directions, such as the x-axis or y-axis or the z-axis. Then you can have longitudinal phonons and also transverse phonons. But if you go in some generic direction, which is neither x nor y nor z, nor the cube diagonal, or the body diagonal, nor the face diagonal, then in general, the directions will be a little bit more complicated. So you'll evaluate this for a square lattice and see how things work there. In a hexagonal crystal, this will work perfectly. In two dimensions, you can still have an isotropic solid in this sense, but generally solids are not that isotropic. All of them nonetheless share the property that they have vibrational waves whose frequency scales as v times k, where v depends on the direction, perhaps, in any ordered solid. But the speed of sound may not be the same, even for phonons of the same type. All right, so let's get to our last topic of the day, the quantization of vibrational waves. So the quantization proceeds just like it would for a simple harmonic oscillator. We'll take the canonical root rather than the path integral root. Sorry to disappoint you today. So So we'll start with a Lagrangian. Then we'll define canonical momenta. Hamiltonian, and then we'll quantize. So I'll remind you that our Lagrangian is an integral. Rho, let's do it in one dimension, in fact. So it'll be rho u dot squared over 2, so that we don't mess with momenta, with directions, sigma u prime squared divided by 2. So I'll make a parallel with a particle in n dimensions, where the Lagrangian would be something like the sum over n, going from 1 to capital N, m x dot n squared divided by 2 minus whatever potential energy. That depends on the coordinates only. So we quantize this problem in the same way, right? So we start with doing what? Identifying the momenta, right? And that's the partial derivative with respect to velocity of the Lagrangian, right? So that would be m times x n dot. Then from there, we get to a Hamiltonian, which is tn x n dot minus the Lagrangian, summation over doubly repeated indices. And it's a function of coordinates and momenta. And what do we do then? We pronounce them to be operators, right? And so we say xm pn is minus ih bar times the Kronecker delta. Coordinates and momenta for different directions commute. Coordinates commute, momenta commute. Yeah.
Why do we quantize this theory?
Because it turns out that at low temperatures, the properties of vibrations in a crystal are quantum. It's a necessity, it turns out. In fact, if you take a typical crystal, it only behaves like a classical system at temperatures above 300 kelvins, sometimes way above 300 kelvins, like 800 kelvins. And at temperatures like 100 kelvins, it will be a quantum system. That has to do with the frequency of the oscillations, right? So these are harmonic oscillators with frequencies omega. And so if h bar omega is much greater than kBT, the thermal energy, then it has quantum properties. And it turns out that frequencies of many phonons or many vibrations in the crystal well exceed the thermal energy right here. So if you take a metal in it, a good metal like copper will have the characteristic temperature scale of 1,000 kelvins for that. So at lower temperatures, your vibrational waves have to be quantized. You just cannot afford to ignore that. So here we perform the exact same problem.
Did you put minus sign on purpose? Like when we
plus. Yes. P with x would be a minus. X with p would be a plus. Okay, very good. So we perform pretty much the same program. And so our coordinate field is now u of x. We introduce the momentum field. Pi of x, which is the functional derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to u dot. Time derivative of that, right? which is the same as the partial derivative of the Lagrangian density with respect to u dot. Which can be read off there, and so that's going to be rho times u of x. U dot, exactly. Mass times velocity. What is momentum? What else is momentum, right? Okay, so our pi is that. Our Hamiltonian is going to be the integral over x, pi of x, u dot of x, minus the Lagrangian, which is this. All right, so it's rho u dot squared over 2. Plus sigma u prime squared over 2. And since pi is rho u dot, the first and second term partially cancel, and same story as with particles, we have integral dx, pi squared of x divided by 2 rho, that's our potential, that's our kinetic energy expressed in terms of the momentum field, plus sigma u prime of x squared. And quantization will amount to promoting our classical fields to operator fields. Done in the exact same way as with discrete coordinates, except the Kronecker delta becomes replaced with the Dirac delta function, right? So we have u of x, u of y, where y is not a different dimension, it's just a different potentially coordinate. This commutator is 0. Pi of x commutes with itself at different points. And u of x, pi of y gives you my, sorry, plus I h bar delta function of x minus y. So formally, that's pretty much it. Except we can't do anything yet. No calculation. And why not? Why can't we do calculations with that yet? It's because our Hamiltonian is not yet diagonal, right? So momenta only interact with themselves at a given point. But coordinate field interacts with itself at different points, u at x and u at x plus dx. So we have to diagonalize this first, right? Make a diagonal in some representation. How?
Free transform,
right? Make use of the translational symmetry. So we're going to write u of x. So let's pretend we have a periodic crystal, right? So u of x, or u of 0, t is the same as u of lt. So we maintain exactly the same properties at the edges. In other words, u of x plus l, t is the same as u of x, t. Or imagine a chain that's made into a ring. It's just more convenient because it restores what? Translational symmetry, right? Fourier transform is convenient when there is translational symmetry, and if you have a chain with open ends, the symmetry is broken by the presence of the ends, and so that's the trick. So in that case, we can expand u of x in a Fourier series, 1 over root L times the sum over certain wave numbers, u sub k times e to I k x. And the wave numbers are not arbitrary, but they have to be such that the wave is periodic. So it's 2 pi over L times an integer. Right? 1, 2, 3, 0, minus 1, minus 2, minus 3, and so on. So these waves, if you shift them by distance L, they get the same value. Right? So they're invariant under shifts by distance L. So this is our continuum formulation. How would it change if I did it on the lattice? So right now I have discrete momenta which are peppering this k-axis all the way from minus infinity to infinity. If I tell you this is a crystal, what will change? We'll have to restrict ourselves to the first Brillouin zone. So we'll be doing it from here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, to here. So this would be pi over a, and this would be minus pi over a. So k would have to be between these. So in condensed matter physics, we naturally have a high frequency cutoff, high momentum cutoff. So there's one thing that I have to actually stipulate here, and that's the requirement that field U be real. Displacements are real, so U star of X is the same as U of X. So that introduces a slight complication to this procedure. UK are complex numbers, and for the amplitudes UK, that translates into a condition uk star equals u minus k. So k and minus k are no longer independent. The complex numbers will be complex conjugate on opposite sides of the k-axis. So pi of x, of course, has the same property. Pi star of x is pi of x, and pi k star is pi of minus k. So I'm nearing 1.5 hours. You guys tired? You are. OK, so am I. So I'm going to just sketch the rest of it. And you can read the full quantization procedure in the book by Alt, London, Simons. Does this name sound familiar? So Alt, Lund, plus Simons, and I'll have my notes posted also, so you can see them there. So basically, once you introduce these, after the Fourier transform, your Hamiltonian will look like this. It'll be sum over k rho times pi dagger k, pi star k, pi k, divided by 2, plus sigma k squared uk star uk, divided by 2.
This is before quantization?
It's before. We're not quantizing yet, right? So we just rewrote the classical Lagrangian, Hamiltonian, right? So here we have k squared coming from the differentiation. We had two derivatives, spatial ones, and so that's where it comes from. Right? And so now this thing appears diagonal, except we have to take care of the dependence of k and minus k. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to sum over only positive momenta, and then the coefficient will double, right? Because pi star k is the same as pi minus k, and vice versa. So you'll have rho pi star k pi k plus sigma k squared u star k uk. So then it's fully like the simple harmonic oscillator. And you know what to do there. You can introduce the creation and annihilation operators, which are not Hermitian, right? Annihilation and creation operators. So AK would be the square root of, and the coefficient of the square root, I always have to look up. Sorry, I taught my undergraduate quantum just last semester, and I'm not up to speed. So it's going to be rho omega k divided by 2h bar, where omega k is the frequency of the oscillator, which is square root of sigma over rho times k. Absolute value of k, because both on the right and on the left of 0, it's positive. Multiplied by uk plus I pi k divided by 2 rho omega k. If you compare this, sorry, not 2, but just rho omega k. If you compare it to the expressions for the simple harmonic oscillator in your undergrad textbook, that's precisely that, right? So a dagger k, and now we can pretend we've quantized these u's, right? So the quantization condition would be, I'll specify what it is. So it'll be u star k or u dagger k minus I pi dagger k divided by rho omega k. Right, the quantization we have previously written for the field, and we can now write it for the Fourier amplitudes. You might imagine what it is like. So u k with u dagger of k prime, these will commute. The momentum operators will also commute. And the coordinate and momentum operators will not commute for the same momentum or wave number. So the only subtlety here is you have to take u and pi dagger, or pi with the opposite wave number, right, in order for them not to commute. And so you've got these. And remembering that k and minus k are not entirely independent, you might worry that an annihilation operator here also acts like a creation operator for the other one, looking at this, which would be a disaster. Why? Because there's a fundamental difference between creation and annihilation operators, isn't there?
You would have a back of that.
Exactly. Right. So you can only go so far down, but you can keep going up. So we have to make sure that the operators for the other mode will be linearly independent, right? So my a minus k would be the same prefactors times u minus k plus I pi minus k divided by rho omega k. So if you compare a minus k and a dagger k, they're actually different. Although u dagger k is u minus k, we have the minus I here and you have a plus I there. So this pair of operators is distinct from that pair of operators. U dagger minus k minus I pi dagger minus k of rho omega k. And so the last thing I'll write is the resulting Hamiltonian, which has the form you know and love from the simple harmonic oscillator. H is going to be the sum over all wave numbers, h bar omega k times a dagger k, a k plus a half. So the energy of the mode with wave number k has the lowest eigenvalue of h bar omega k over 2, the vacuum energy, and then it goes up in steps. So these are the celebrated phonons. In a one-dimensional crystal, these are just longitudinal phonons because there are no transverse directions. In three-dimensional crystals, there will be, for each wave number or wave vector, would be, roughly speaking, one longitudinal phonon and two transverse ones. They won't necessarily be exactly longitudinal and transverse, but they'll be close to these directions. And if you measured, for instance, the specific heat as a function of temperature for this crystal, in three dimensions, it would initially rise cubically. So this would be proportional to T cubed before leveling off and saturating. Right? The saturated value would be just the number of phonon modes times KB. right? A classical harmonic oscillator has the specific heat of KB, the energy KBT. So if you differentiate it with respect to T, this is what you'll get. And the crossover happens from the T cube behavior to a constant. It happens around a temperature called theta D, where D stands for Debye. So the Debye temperature is the characteristic frequency of vibrational waves in a solid. So typically, it would be a few hundred kelvins. Although in softer solids, it might be lower. So lead, for instance, is soft, and so it has a much lower Debye temperature. All right. Thank you for your attention, and I will see you tomorrow.
Any questions? Yes, is there a reason that these few hundred Kelvin are approximately like the temperature scale at which we live?
Temperature of?
Like the scale at which we live.
Sorry, the scale of what?
The temperature scale at which we live is approximately a few hundred Kelvin. Is there a connection between this and the temperature that's...
It's connected to the melting temperature, pretty much. So lead has a low melting temperature, and therefore the Debye temperature is also lower.
Okay.